Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Karen Delaney, Delaney Legal, PLLC. Karen, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so thrilled to be here.
So Karen, if you would just kind of tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, your background, and maybe your path into the law.
I grew up in the Dallas area. I went to University of Texas for undergrad and then WashU in St. Louis for law school. And although I wish I had an inspirational story about why I ended up as a lawyer, I think I was a pretty typical upper middle class kid who first thought I wanted to be a doctor and then got to organic chemistry and realized, oh no, this is not for me. And tried to think about what I would be good at and landed on law school and legal practice because I had always been a very strong writer and my extremely limited understanding of the law led me to conclude that if I were a good writer, I probably would be a decent lawyer. So here we are.
So you started out after law school going to a firm?
I did. I went to Gardier Wynn Sewell, which is now fully Gardier, and I did general business litigation there for about 5 years. Then went in-house to be a corporate generalist at GameStop, where I was part of a small team handling all of the company's legal needs. And then in 2017, I moved over to Half Price Books, which most of your Texas listeners will probably be familiar with, but it's a national retailer that sells new and used books. And I thought it might give me some more exposure to corporate governance because it was just me and the GC there. But after I'd been there for a couple of months, the GC left and I took over the legal department. And then I left Half Price Books at the end of May 2020 and spent some time at home with the kids and then dove into a solo practice.
I want to cover more ground than what you just traced there, but what made you decide to go into solo practice, having had all that experience as an in-house lawyer?
The thought had crossed my mind about jumping into solo work occasionally over the years, and I'd always dismissed it because I think there were a couple of mental hurdles that I couldn't get past. Number one, how would I apply my skill set and leverage my existing network to be successful? As a corporate generalist, I was always hiring experts. And so I struggled to think about, well, could I be an external GC? My network really falls into three buckets. It's other lawyers that I've worked with, whether at Gardier or outside counsel. It's other in-house lawyers. And then it's the business folks that I've worked with over the years. And my speculation, right or wrong, is that to develop a external GC practice, you probably are working with companies that don't have a dedicated legal function yet. And that's not really where my network lies, right? And so I really couldn't clear, well, how do I apply this in a way that would allow me to be successful? And then just the overhead, because this was pre-pandemic, and I think a lot of us were still wed to that idea of commuting into an office every day. And somebody who was in-house and didn't have a book of business to take somewhere, that seemed really risky to have significant potential overhead and no clients. And how do you kind of make that work? But I think taking some time off cleared some space for me to think about how I would apply both my skill set, leverage my network, and also how I wanted my practice to fit into my life instead of my life fitting into the space left over by my practice. I also knew that my in-house friends were getting absolutely crushed because legal demands exploded as a result of the pandemic, and frequently staffing in in-house departments haven't really kept up with those demands. And what I focus my practice on now is negotiating and redlining contracts for corporate clients. My clients all have legal departments. I work with one startup, but by and large, my clients are large established companies who need help making sure that contracts keep going. Because for me, as a corporate generalist, that was frequently a pain point where I was responsible for so many legal needs. There are emergencies and fires that pop up every day that have to be put out. How do you keep those contracts flowing smoothly, quickly, so that your business partners can get done what they needed to get done? And even when I was at Half Price Books and we had decided I needed to offload some of this work so that I could focus my attention on other priorities, when I reached out to other in-house counsel at other companies and said, hey, who do you have do this work for you? Very often the answer was, I haven't been able to find somebody. Let me know when you do. And knowing post-COVID that people were much more comfortable with somebody who might not have an office, it's not necessarily reflective of the quality of legal services that you are going to receive because we've all been working from home for the past couple of years, lowered those hurdles, and I kind of found my niche and made the jump.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
It seems like so often lawyers in your position try to become like a fractional general counsel and maintain that sort of generalist approach and do what you said, you know, going and being sort of outside general counsel for a company. But you mentioned finding your niche. That was what was coming to my mind as you were talking, is that's really quite an interesting niche that you're filling, if negotiating contracts on behalf of other companies. And it sounds like there was a real need there. So congratulations on finding your place. It seems like relatively quickly in your solo practice.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think, yeah, it is something that a lot of companies struggle with. It's a need, and especially being able to lower the overhead and make yourself competitive. There's an opening there.
Kind of curious about your journey, because this seems like an interesting place to end up, having started at a big firm as kind of a business litigator. How did you initially make your transition from firm to in-house?
I was a fifth-year associate, and I loved the team that I was working with and the work that I was doing. But I got a call out of the blue from a recruiter who cold called me and said, well, GameStop's looking to hire somebody. Would you be interested? And I had no idea that GameStop was even located in the area. And I said, you mean the place in the mall? And I also had no idea how big they were at that time. They had, I think, about 6,500 stores worldwide, 21 countries. They had 48,000 employees, about $10 billion in revenue, $10 or $11 billion. I had been thinking, I like my work, I love my team, but partnership is looming. And partnership seems like you get a lot more pie for having won the pie eating contest, right? Do I really want to be a partner? And initially I thought, well, I don't know about going in-house and I don't know about GameStop, but I haven't interviewed anywhere in 6 years since 2L OCI. So I might as well kick the tires, let's shake the dust off and go interview. But as I interviewed and I learned more about the position and more about the company, it sounded like a really exciting opportunity, especially because most companies of that size have extremely siloed legal departments, where you might have somebody who is the senior counsel for European data privacy. But the way that GameStop was organized at that time, they had a very small legal department. Everybody was a corporate generalist. Everybody was expected to be able to figure out how to handle any legal issue that came in the door. And that's a really exciting space to be in, because one of the reasons that I got into litigation is I've always been a lifelong learner. I'm a nerd. I like learning about things that I have no business knowing about.
And you're among friends.
I feel like I'm in good company here.
Yeah.
But to get to be in a space in-house where you have the opportunity to work on so many new and interesting things and also respond to new developments in the law is a really cool place to be and a unique opportunity for a company of that size.
I think that there's a little bit of a sort of misimpression that firm lawyers have of, oh, you know, in-house jobs, they're so cushy, this sort of 9 to 5, no billable hours thing. But the reality is, I think you said it earlier, there's kind of fires that pop up all the time in areas that you may not know anything about.
I think that's right. I think it also really matters where you are in the hierarchy of the department. It may be that when you first come in as a counsel and you're a relatively junior lawyer, your responsibilities may be fairly defined. And there are people above you on the hierarchy who are going to be the ones handling fires because they're the ones that have the credibility, the authority, and the pay grade to be dealing with those. But I think as you gain more experience, more trust and credibility with your clients, the likelihood that you are going to be on the front line for dealing with those issues increases. And it also depends on the practice too, because as a corporate generalist, yes, you are going to be the line of defense for any legal issue that comes up for the company. But depending on your practice, if you're in a more siloed area, that just may not be the case.
I heard you refer to clients. I've heard a lot of current and former in-house lawyers use that same terminology, even though we think, oh, well, you're going in-house, you're going to have the supposedly cush job. But at the end of the day, you still have a client relationship. Your client is your happens to be your employer. But would you say that your client most often was the business people, like the directors in the organization, or who did you consider to be your client in your in-house jobs?
Well, let's separate out who's my client from an ethical perspective versus who's my client from a service perspective. My client is the organization from an ethical perspective, right? But as a corporate generalist, and anybody in-house is probably going to have a multitude of internal clients because you are, at the end of the day, a service provider to the business and the various people who make the business work.
How is the transition and kind of mindset shift from being in a firm, you're sort of the revenue center and you control it that way, and in-house, maybe cost center is not the right word, but you're not bringing the revenue like some of the business people are and the salespeople. Has that kind of changed the way that you approach legal problems?
I would describe it as a cost center. I think at most companies, it's probably a cost center, and that does necessarily shift how you look at problems. I think it requires a very problem-solving, pragmatic orientation because there are a lot of people internally at companies who may have had an experience with some lawyer in their life, some capacity, whether it's their internal legal department or it's some other legal issue they've dealt with, where they don't necessarily have the highest regard for your ability as a lawyer to solve problems. They may regard you as the department of no. I've heard the legal department, not at GameStop or Half Price Books, but I have heard other people refer to their legal departments as where good ideas go to die. That crushes me as an in-house lawyer because that is never how I would ever want internal clients to think about what I can provide to the organization. So you have to be a problem solver. You have to have an appetite for risk too. I think most businesses have a healthy appetite for risk, whereas external counsel often may not, or there may be a misalignment on what the appropriate amount of risk is and how you tailor your advice to the amount of risk that the organization is willing to undertake. And so that dovetails with being a pragmatist, right? Because there are very few things as an in-house lawyer that I think you have to say flat out, no, we are at the end of the discussion, we're done. There's usually a way to accomplish what the business needs to get done. It may just need some tinkering or a more creative mindset to get it solved. So you really do have to be a problem solver.
And there's our parallel between in-house and appellate lawyers right there, because so much of what appellate lawyers do, if anyone is listening to this thinking about, they're talking about all this in-house stuff, what does it really have to do with Texas appellate law? I see the parallel now because that's so much of what we do is problem solving. We're usually trying to fix a problem. It could be before the fact, ideally, but often it's after the fact. And so being the problem solver in-house, I would assume, referring back to your clever play on words with the Department of No, I would assume that your preference would have been to have the opportunity to say yes or no rather than try to fix after the fact and clean up a mess.
Sure. The best outside counsel that I worked with during my in-house career were the ones that want to be right there with you, rowing the boat in the same direction and helping you solve those problems. And there's nothing more frustrating than being on a call with an outside lawyer, hearing all the reasons we can't do something without any suggestions for how we could move forward.
And that is an area we kind of wanted to cover, was working with outside counsel, and in particular, outside counsel in litigation. I feel like as outside counsel, a lot of times you get a piece of litigation or get dropped into a litigation and you're thinking, solve this problem, this fire. And it really does take kind of a mindset shift to step back and think about it in the way that you're thinking about it on the client side of, here's the problem that we need to solve and help me find solutions, as opposed to with the lawsuit.
How do you find solutions? What is the overall organizational mindset related to litigation? Because there are clients who will spend every penny to scorch the earth. I was never one of them. I always have believed in resolving litigation as quickly and efficiently as possible. I think there are a lot of outside counsel who are accustomed to the process of litigation. We're going to go through discovery. This will take 18 to 24 months. Maybe something will go up on appeal, depending on what the issue is. But we're going to sort of march through that process without examining early on whether we should, what are the risks associated with that? Is there a way to get creative about resolving this? How can we create leverage to improve our posture to resolve this? Whether it is pursuing something to arbitration, to trial, or resolving it informally through settlement.
What do you see in the ways that outside counsel communicate with you that you think they'd either do well or maybe don't do well, or you wish that they knew would make your life easier?
Well, I think you hit on number one, please make my life easier. It's the thing that every client wants, especially in-house counsel, wants from their outside counsel. And communication really is paramount. And I think where a lot of lawyers could focus is on the communication for non-legal audiences. Because the baseline expectation, especially for hiring an appellate lawyer, an appellate specialist, is that I already expect that you're going to be an excellent writer and you are going to be an excellent communicator for sophisticated consumers of legal services, i.e. the judges on an appellate panel or me, because we have a common legal background, we speak a common legal language. But that doesn't always translate over to clients and explaining concepts, risks, why we should pursue particular paths to clients and translating that into plain language. And when you think about making things easier for in-house counsel, I think put things in perspective. Like, let's say the brief that you're working on is Earth, and zoom out and we'll see our solar system. Zoom out from that, you'll see where our solar system lives in our nice little arm of the Milky Way. Zoom out to the Milky Way and then zoom out to the galaxies that are around us. That might be my area of responsibility as in-house counsel. And we're talking about Earth. So to the extent that we can reduce the amount of time that I have to spend dealing with this one particular issue, I can focus on all the other things that are pressing and urgent in sort of my various constellations of responsibility. And maybe the business people that I am reporting to, they have the whole universe potentially, right? So even though this issue is very important to us and we spend a lot of time and blood, sweat, and tears on it, there's so much else going on. And I'll give an example. I had an outside counsel that I was working with on a complex legal issue that had the attention of the client's executives. And I had asked this outside counsel, can you put together just something quick that I can forward on that will explain our recommendation, the basis for that recommendation? And I got back an email that probably was about 2.5 pages long. And I didn't even have to finish reading it to know I can't forward this to the executives because they are, A, not going to read it, and they're going to be really frustrated with me that I would send them such a thing. So I said, hey, can we chop this down a little bit? Let's try and get this a little shorter. And what I got back was probably 2 pages, still too long. So at that point, I gave up and I managed to chop it down myself to a couple of high-level sentences and maybe a paragraph and then send it off to the executives. But that's a really frustrating experience because although that was an urgent issue that had the attention of several of our executives, there are so many other issues that are also urgent that also have their attention, right? And so to the extent that you can easily translate plain language, drop the jargon, be a compact communicator, which I think any appellate specialist will appreciate how difficult it is and how much time and energy can go into being concise about how you communicate. That's just such a boon to in-house counsel. And it's so enjoyable to work with people who understand how to do that. It makes the practice a lot more fun.
As an outside lawyer working with in-house counsel, One thing that I had to learn over the years was the corporate objectives are not necessarily the same as your preferred course of action as a litigator. And you have to keep in mind those business purposes, and just ties into what you're saying about the importance of communication. Because if that communication breaks down and you go very far afield, as opposed to really focusing on meeting the client's objective, that can really be a problem later on, especially if you're talking about time spent that really wasn't what the client really wanted to pursue. Even if it were a sound litigation strategy, there's kind of a balancing act that comes in between doing what you need to do as the lawyer versus doing what needs to be done to meet the client's objective, that I think especially younger lawyers really haven't had the opportunity to learn about that balancing act yet. So it's a great point about making your life easier through communication. It seems like really you can't over-communicate, especially early on in the relationship and working with an in-house lawyer. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that goes back to what you alluded to as well with the budgets. I drop all of that into effective communication, but also developing a relationship of trust, which is also incredibly important. And I think on that budgeting side, you're right, over-communicating in terms of where we see things going, particularly if the client has asked for a budget. I know I have been in a number of situations where it feels like outside counsel views the budget as a hurdle that has to be cleared in order to get hired. And then it goes into a drawer and nobody ever looks at it again. And one of the worst experiences as an in-house lawyer is getting a bill, that opening that envelope and thinking you're getting a $5,000 bill and instead it's a $30,000 bill, or you thought you were going to get a $100,000 bill and instead it's a $200,000 bill, and feeling really blindsided by that. And so to the extent that we can over-communicate, number one, so that I can trust that outside counsel is aligned not only with achieving the litigation objectives that we have discussed, but being somebody who is also sort of a keeper of the purse and sensitive to the spend and whether it makes sense to continue to spend that way and to keep thinking about that. I always appreciate that partnership with outside counsel.
I imagine that a lot of times the objectives in the litigation change over time, whether it's because something has changed internally, maybe your goals have realigned or other developments have come up, or something changes in the litigation that may change the strategy as well.
I always in-house tried to do a deep evaluation very early on of the case to understand what we know. How do we evaluate the claims? Nobody has a crystal ball, but how do we ballpark our likelihood of success based on what we know today? What don't we know? And how would that impact our analysis? Because my experience generally has been the longer litigation drags on, the outcome doesn't necessarily improve that much. It's just how much everybody's invested into getting there and whether you've entrenched somebody. If you're thinking about being a corporate defendant who is responding to a plaintiff, how much that plaintiff's attorney has now invested into the case in terms of their time and sort of entrenched themselves. Yes, you have to be responsive to things that happen in the litigation. And there's so much, obviously, that's outside of your control because you're dealing with the court and you're dealing with opposing parties and witnesses and all that kinds of stuff. But ideally, you would have a fairly good idea from the outset, benchmarking your risk and whether pursuing this litigation is going to make it worth it. And at what point you're going to pull the ripcord if you need to walk away.
I think about communications that I've seen where the lawyers on the outside worry too much about sort of the CYA approach. And so they give you every possibility, every risk, every time, and kind of miss the bottom line a lot of times because they just want to make sure you can't later say, oh, you didn't tell me that. And it kind of obscures maybe the more important points.
But also it's alienating because clients know you're doing, we know what you're doing. And if an outside counsel feels the need to document, then by all means, you have to do what you feel like you need to do. But that always, I think, places your in-house counterpart back on their feet a little bit because it does feel so adversarial and it's not a partnership mindset of, hey, look, that maybe these are problems, right? But what is the path forward, especially where that's not necessarily clear?
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
What about attorneys who maybe are in a few years in practice, kind of like you were, that think they might want to transition from firm or whatever they're doing to an in-house role? Do you have any tips or thoughts on that process for them?
Sure. I think if you're not familiar with how in-house legal departments work or what needs might be out there, hop on Indeed or goinhouse.com and start looking at what opportunities are out there and evaluating how your skill set matches those opportunities. Because there are areas of the law that seem to be very highly in demand for companies. Employment law is one of them. I find that litigation, oftentimes, if you're not at a mega company, it maybe is not. So how do you fit into that? If you really are determined to try and make the leap in-house, do you need to think about pivoting your practice and how would you make that work? Always tailor your job, your resume to the job that you're going to apply for. Never send a generic resume. I've seen that. If you get to the interview stage, research, research, research. I interviewed a lot of people when I was at GameStop. And I think very few knew very much about GameStop before they sat down with us. And it's delightful when you meet somebody who has put some time and effort into researching the company and is conversant about things that might be in the news related to the company, who maybe dug into the website, or if it's a public company, who looked at the annual report that's filed with the SEC. That's a great place to start. Work your network. Obviously, your mileage may vary. Know the people that you're working with. But if you are at a law firm, ideally, you would hope that they would want to help you transition into in-house practice because you are a future client of the firm. And I realize that's not the case for everybody, but consider who can help you with that. You know, it's a touchy subject too, but from a financial preparedness perspective, depending on what kind of firm you are at, if you are at a big law firm, there's a chance that you might be taking a pay cut in order to come in-house. And are you able to make that work? And if not, is there a way to prepare yourself to try and to make that work? Essentially, the golden handcuffs problem.
As far as kind of learning on the job, I know you did big sort of business litigation and then went in and became a corporate generalist. How were you able to kind of develop those skills on the fly?
You rely a lot on your outside counsel to learn and to teach you, and rely on your counterparts in the legal department to help you figure out what the company's culture is and how to navigate that culture, because every company is so different in terms of how people like to communicate, how forward the company culture is, how open people are to discussing ideas. And there are some cultures where people are afraid to share ideas, and there are others where confrontation is just expected. So how do you swim through and navigate all of that? You have to rely on your peers a lot to learn that. And I think you also have to, and this may go back to if you're thinking about going in-house in an area, maybe as a corporate generalist and not necessarily a specialist, but how comfortable are you with navigating ambiguity? Because in-house, there's so much of it. And that may be ambiguity because the path forward is not clear. It may be ambiguity because there are multiple acceptable paths forward. And there are some people that are not that comfortable with making a decision that's not necessarily the best decision, that it's not clear that that is the best path forward. And that's okay. That's just something to know about yourself. And other people develop more comfort with it over time as you get that practice and you realize that the world's not going to collapse down around you.
Did you find when you went from Gardeer to in-house that suddenly you had a lot of people inviting you to lunch and were interested in developing a relationship with you, and maybe that they hadn't done that before?
It's funny, Todd. My social calendar seems a little emptier since I went solo.
I always try to be mindful. I don't want to overburden anyone with lunch invitations, but especially maybe among the younger lawyers, said it's like, oh, Karen just went in-house. I need a business development lunch.
And I think that's fine. I'm a pretty social person. And so I like getting together with most people, I guess, regardless of the reason. I enjoy making those connections and keeping those connections. But I think there is a way to do it that fosters authentic connection instead of looking like a shark and probably builds on a pre-existing connection, right? I mean, if you ignored me every day at the law firm and then send me an invitation to go out to lunch, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
I'm super involved in the local bar and the state bar. And I always heard from in-house lawyers, and one of the reasons they don't like to go to bar events is because they can sort of get cornered. People find out, oh, you work for GameStop is an example. Oh, you work for GameStop. And then you can't get away because they're wanting to establish that connection with you in the 5-minute period of time that they have at some bar event. But I had to ask that question. I think that's a great point. And it goes back to a theme that we talk about a lot on our show, which one is authenticity, but two is just treating people the way you want to be treated. And obviously, if someone didn't show interest in getting to know a lawyer before they went in-house, a healthy little dose of skepticism is probably in order.
Right.
You kind of talked about why you made your choice to go solo and your transition from that. One of the things I think is interesting is the idea of a virtual practice, which I frankly don't know 2 years ago I really had heard much about, but now it seems like that's a lot more common. How did you decide, or how did you go about setting up that world instead of a sort of brick and mortar setup?
Well, I knew that to target the kind of work that I want to do with the clients I want to have, I have to manage my overhead extremely carefully. And I don't care to have a lease, which means, we're recording right now from my office, which is a guest bedroom in our house. So I knew I wanted to work out of my house since COVID kind of opened that as a possibility. I didn't want to maintain paper files. Part of that is just not having to deal with the administrative side of that because I don't have an assistant. It is just me. So any time I spend on non-billable things is obviously time that takes away from billing. And so I operate very much from a keep it simple, stupid perspective where I'm trying to keep everything as simple as I possibly can to reduce my own overhead, to reduce my own administrative time. And I also just didn't want to collect a bunch of files that I'm going to have to cart around with me every time we move. And I just thought it would be easier to maintain things digitally, even though my natural tendency is I'm a pack rat. I keep a lot of things. So this is a little bit of a change for me, but it's been nice. And it's opened up a lot of possibilities for maintaining, managing a practice that maybe weren't open to people a couple of years ago. I don't know, because I wasn't trying to practice as a solo a couple of years ago.
I want to ask you, as a legal technology dork and a former solo practitioner myself, I want to ask you about your tech stack. So like, what kind of stuff are you using to help maintain that keep it simple, stupid approach? Like, how are you keeping your files, and what technology are you using, if any, that's notable?
Maybe it's not notable. I mean, I think for my practice, I need a couple of things, right? I need a computer that works. I need word processing software. I need subscriptions to Westlaw for research purposes and forms and things like that. And practice management software and Adobe, right? That's kind of it. And I invested heavily in my laptop. I have a nice Mac PowerBook that was very expensive, but I've always been an Apple user. And again, from the keep it simple, stupid perspective, I just wanted something that I perceived to be easy and that would reduce friction in my practice and getting sidelined by technology issues that I might not be equipped to really resolve. But I don't need much. And I think that was one of the things that was surprising to me, because it's pretty overwhelming when you do decide to go solo to try and figure out what is it that I really need, especially if you're trying to be cognizant of your costs and as you're building business, trying not to let those costs overwhelm you. So I made that decision to invest there, but otherwise have kept it pretty minimal. I'm working on a website, but I haven't really found a need for one yet, because thinking about where my business comes from, it's all word of mouth. It is all referrals. I'm not necessarily targeting an individual who's Googling divorce attorney or best trust and estates lawyer in Dallas. That's not necessarily my target audience. So website in the works, but not necessarily necessary. I don't do any advertising at this point. I don't invest in any advertising for that same reason. And so, Todd, to answer your question, the tech stack, it's a Mac. I store things in the cloud, and I use cloud software, and probably the cornerstone is Microsoft Word and my practice management software.
I love that sort of lean approach. And certainly in today's world, you can do that in a way that wasn't possible 15 years ago or 20 years ago. And you have the added benefit of, as you point out, COVID kind of made it acceptable to run a practice from anywhere. And so really, I think solo practice is a great thing to do. And I don't discourage anyone from doing it. I had a really good experience doing it myself. But I always thought that what really made it workable was the technology available, even when I did it, going back many years ago. But it just seems to have gotten better. So between the combination of whether it's a Mac or whatever kind of system you use, and the ability to work from home and not be shunned because of that, not have people think you're not a real lawyer if you're going to work from home. In litigation practice, it might be tougher to some degree, but I think it's still doable, and certainly was doable from an appellate practice side. But doing what you do, and generally your clients being in-house lawyers and companies, I think it's great what you've been able to put together. It's good to hear about it.
Yeah. And I think there's so much technology out there. And like I said, I have tried to keep it simple for myself. And part of that also is just an appetite for diving into those things and learning them, expenses, things like that. But there are so many cool gadgets, so many apps out there that can really be powerful for your practice. And I think if anybody is curious either about maybe going solo, or even if you're not solo, how might I improve my technology? How might I go virtual? One resource that I thought was that I found just invaluable, it's called Lawyer on the Beach. It's a private Facebook group. Are you, Todd, you smile. Are you in that?
No, but I have this image of a beach lounge chair and some lawyer in their laptop. It just, it's such a calming, peaceful image to me. Lawyer on the beach, practice from anywhere.
So shout out to Lawyer on the Beach. It's a fantastic group, and it's oriented towards practitioners who either are fully virtual or who aspire to move to a fully virtual practice. And whether you are a family law practitioner, or you do trusts and estates, or you're a lawyer like me supporting corporations, it's where I learned so much about what do I need to start a solo practice? Where do I go to get a logo? What do I need for my website? Like, where can I go to get that done? What are my best options for practice management software out there? Because there's so much practice management software. And so let me sort of stand on the shoulders of the people who have come before me to learn about those things and to take advantage of those resources. So I do really highly recommend that if anybody wants to learn more.
I'll add a couple of resources to that just from my own knowledge. One is myshingle.com, which is Carolyn Elephant, who's been unapologetic solo for most of her career, I think. And she's been writing about this. She has wrote a book and just a ton of resources along the lines of what you were describing. And then along the way, I managed to make friends with a lawyer in New Orleans named Ernie Svensson. And he's known as Ernie the Attorney. And he's coached a lot of solo lawyers. He's a really kind of a former lawyer. He was a big firm lawyer who decided he wanted to teach lawyers how to use technology efficiently and for the benefit of their own mostly solo practices. And so those out there is other resources to check out for anybody who's listening who wants to pursue the idea of opening a solo practice.
I think that's great. There's so many resources, and I'm always just very pleasantly surprised at how willing people are to share their time, complete strangers who are willing to share their time and help you.
What are you seeing as the pros and cons of solo practice in your experience so far?
Well, number one, I love it so far.
That's awesome.
Tell us again how long you've been doing it.
I think I really committed to it in about September of last year, because I left Half Price Books in May of 2020. And at that point, when the pandemic started, I had an 18-month-old and a 3.5-year-old. Now, a 5-year-old who's about to start kindergarten in the fall, and my youngest is about to be 4. And we kept them home for a year. And once they went back to school, I started interviewing for other in-house positions, but I just couldn't get this idea of trying to start a solo practice out of my head. And it felt like if there's going to be a time to take this risk, then now is the time. Because once I get another in-house job, I'm not quitting it to start a solo practice. I mean, I know myself well enough to do that. So this seems like the time. And I actually was in the middle of interviewing for 2 jobs with organizations here in Dallas, in-house positions. But I went to lunch, I'll never forget it. I went to lunch with a friend of mine who knew that I was agonizing over this decision. And I was telling her about these interviews. And I'll leave out the expletives, but I'll never forget. She looked at me and she said, "What are you doing? I don't understand why. Like, you have a great idea. You are going to be successful if you let yourself be successful. What are we doing talking about interviewing with these other organizations?" And I thought, you're right. I just kind of needed to hear it. I think from another attorney, because of course my husband has always been incredibly supportive, but it was good to hear it from a friend of mine, and decided to make that jump. And the way this is tied to the pros and cons is I had a very solid idea of what do I want to get out of this practice from a life perspective? And no surprise, with two young kids, I want flexibility and I want the ability to do things with my kids, whether that's volunteering with a PTA or it's going to a school play or it's taking somebody to swim lessons to increase my flexibility to do that. And that is an obvious pro. My boss is fantastic. We love her. And the flexibility has been great. My clients are wonderful. I love working with them. It's been a lot of fun. I'm doing interesting things. And because I'm going back to being in good company with fellow nerds, I love learning about other people's businesses and being able to help them. The con side, I think, is it's strange as a corporate generalist who spent about 10 years plugged into a company. It's strange to be on the outside and only be getting little morsels now and not always having a clear idea of what the priorities are here and how this fits into the overall picture, which of course, I mean, can be resolved by asking a lot of questions, but there's just sort of an information deficit there that I am not accustomed to having been on the in-house side for so long. And then, of course, I think just the uncertainty of your paycheck, I'm sort of settling into now that I have enough months under my belt to realize anytime that I'm worried that I don't know what I'm going to do today, there's going to be something in my inbox waiting for me. And people keep coming back and asking me to keep working with them. So that's thrilling. But kind of in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, what if this house of cards collapses? What if there is no more work? And somebody pointed out to me recently, well, aren't you sort of a ruminator by nature, right? I mean, you're a bit of a worrier. So if you weren't worried about this, wouldn't you be worried about something else? Yeah, that's true. If I weren't worried about that, I would be worried about something else. So there's definitely that financial risk, and I have to acknowledge that I'm very lucky in that my husband has a great full-time job with health benefits. Shout out to Southwest Airlines. We love them. And that I have a supportive spouse who, when we sat down and tried to figure out, okay, let's give this a year to let's set X as the revenue goal and give it a year and see how it goes, that I had the space and time and opportunity to flesh that out.
One other thing you often hear about in terms of a con to solo practice, especially a virtual practice, is isolation. So how are you engaging with other people besides Jody and me on Zoom? Zoom, everybody's kind of sick of it, right? So what are you doing to put yourself out in the world to try and maintain that sense of human contact?
I think it's hard, especially after a couple of years where a lot of people have been isolated. And particularly with my clients, we don't do a lot of Zooms or phone calls or Teams meetings. A lot of it is via email. And so it's a challenge to develop and maintain those relationships on the personal side. And that, I think, is where it becomes especially important to sort of let your work speak for itself, because your work has to show, to help develop that relationship. But in terms of outside of this lovely Zoom call, which I thoroughly enjoyed, I try to be pretty conscious about reaching out to people that I haven't talked to in a while or I haven't seen in a while. And hey, let's get something on the calendar for lunch or drinks, or if you feel more comfortable with Zoom, we can do more Zoom. And I try to do something at least once a week where I get out of the house and just reconnect with somebody. And especially if somebody has taken a step back from those interactions because of the pandemic, it's been really, really nice to get back together and see people in person. But I do think you have to be conscious about that. Jody, you know, I'm pretty active on Twitter, so I'm...
You are, and you're great.
Thank you. I engage with people that way as well and have developed a lot of personal connections through Twitter as well. But there are a lot of different ways to do it. And I think you all probably discussed before, a lot of it just depends on what you feel most comfortable with and what you're most likely to be successful with. So I am unlikely to reach out to somebody I don't know and say, hey, let's go to lunch, because I usually find that excruciatingly awkward. But I've been practicing for coming up on 16 years now, and I have a lot of people that I really like that I want to catch up with. And I don't necessarily go, I rarely go with the intention of trying to extract business from them. It's more just, I want to know what's going on with you and catch up. And I like to eat. I like good food. So I'm easily lured out of the house with the promise of good food.
Do you participate in in-house Twitter? I assume there is really a thing. Do you do it now, though? Are you using that as part of your business development strategy?
My Twitter account at this point has always been more personally oriented rather than practice oriented. My name's, and I'm not anonymous by any means, but my name is not on the account, usually because when I first started using Twitter, I was doing a lot of sort of screaming into the void and didn't feel like prospective employers needed to necessarily see all of that if they Googled me. I'll contribute to the conversation now. I think it feels a little bit more awkward to me because I am not on the in-house side anymore. So I have a lot of thoughts about how to be a successful in-house practitioner, how to be successful if you're outside counsel and all of that kind of stuff. But I do have to acknowledge now I'm on the other side. I am a solo. But Twitter is a great place to network, whether it's hashtag in-house Twitter or appellate Twitter is awesome. And that's another place where I'm always just so pleasantly surprised by how willing people are to share time and resources with potentially complete strangers to help lift them up. It's sort of a mentality of abundance, I think, where people are willing to do that.
I love that, a mentality of abundance. Yeah, that's awesome. Karen, this has been a great conversation. We've enjoyed hanging out with you and hearing about your experience and your setting up your practice. And it's just been a great way to spend a part of our afternoon. As we get ready to close out, we've warned you in advance that we like to ask our guests for a tip or a war story as kind of a parting thought. Did you have something that you'd like to offer?
Sure. I'll share a tip. I'll stay away from the war stories because I've had so few clients over the past 10 years that I feel like I can't get too much into specifics on war stories there. But we were talking about effective communication. And to the extent that maybe your listeners haven't thought about it before, haven't heard of this particular train of thought before, one of the things I think about is look at the real estate when you're emailing, look at the real estate on your iPhone. And that's really how much space you have to get your message across. And there are a lot of people who balk at that and think there's so much more analysis and my client needs to know so much more, but everything high level that the client needs to know should be able to go into that space. And that's why when we go back to talking about effective communication earlier, it really does take so much time and effort to make those concise communications that allow your client to know immediately either what it is you need. If you need something from me, it doesn't need to be at the bottom of a 2-page email or a 3-paragraph email. I need to know right away, especially if you're dealing with a general counsel who's getting hundreds of emails a day. Or if you're making a recommendation, making that very compact, plain language recommendation that is going to sort of intuitively make sense to your client and allow them to say, okay, check, done. We can move on to the next thing.
I know I struggle with as an appellate lawyer because you just want to do the brain dump into everything. And so I always have to write too much and then edit it back.
There's a lot of editing. Or I'll even do, I mean, I do the high level summary and then I may do a brief 1-paragraph explanation. And then I'll say more information below. And that's where I can get into the meaty, nitty gritty about why, what the analysis is and why and all of the various factors. And if the client wants to read it, they can. If they want to come back to it, they can. But otherwise, they have everything they need up above.
Well, that's a great tip. And thanks again for being with us today. We really appreciate the chance to visit with you. I'm just grateful to have you.
I really appreciate the chance to visit with you all. I've really enjoyed our conversation and I appreciate you giving me some time.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.